It's been quite a summer politically, yeah? A lot of words get thrown around in such moments. And not only in these moments. One of those words is fascism, which is a very serious problem right now in the world and in our country. So I'd like to set aside the way it gets tossed around for all sorts of things, including making me clean my room or having rules of engagement for any kind of public meeting or game. Those things are not fascist. Well, it depends whether I'm the one giving the order about the room or the one given the order. But as Kat addressed several weeks ago, fascism is a real thing, and it's not just buried in history. So I wanted to run through some of the, actually all of, because my book is not as complicated as her book, I wanted to run through 10 ways to recognize fascist politics, and then turn to then what do we do? Recognizing them being one of the first, most important steps, of course. This comes from, these 10 things come from a book called How Fascism Works by Jason Stanley. Recommend it highly. If you finished Timothy Snyder's book on tyranny, you can have this alongside it on your shelf. Also quite readable and a fascinating history. So Stanley wants to lead us to know that he's focusing on fascist politics, processes, techniques, which he says do not necessarily lead to a fascist regime. He's speaking of these techniques used by people who are striving to gain power, and you will notice that they're not limited to people practicing fascist politics. But taken together, they form a pattern. And when we see that pattern, we're seeing would-be fascists in action. So, I'll go through quickly the 10 signs. You don't have to memorize them, you can look them up, but you might apply them to situations you have lived or are living now and see what you think, if this is something to watch out for, or if you think the word fascism is being overused here. First sign of fascist politics, the mythic past. The mythic past. Fascist politics rewrites, denies, or buries history, replacing it with a myth. The myth of a pure past that has been destroyed and must be restored now in the present. And I'll give you an example, as Stanley does, from a fascist regime or campaign for each one of these. So here's a case of the mythic past and how it tries to erase the real past. In Turkey, a law was passed to make it illegal to insult Turkishness, which meant, among other things, it was not allowed to mention the genocide against the Armenians. Here's a more comical, but still significant example that always comes to mind when I think of people's mythic past. The lyrics of Those Were the Days, you remember the All in the Family theme song? The anti-hero Archie Bunker longs for them. You know, you knew who you were then. Girls were girls and men were men. We could use a man like Herbert Hoover again. And it closes with the memory, the mythic memory. Gee, our old LaSalle ran great. This is the mythic hero, the mythic past that people are trying to return to, that may never have existed, but sure is more fun to remember than actuality. Number two, propaganda. Of course, not limited to fascist politics, but fascists use the language of virtuous ideals to promote evil ends. Liberal democratic ideals such as freedom and reason are the propagandistic mask for their opposites. Control and irrationality. So, for example, when most of the slave states seceded, they couched their argument that they had the right to enslave people in the language of liberty and self-determination. This is how we will be free. This is us pursuing the liberal democratic ideal of being able to determine our own future. And when I say liberal democratic, I'm quoting Stanley, it does not mean liberal like politically liberal like we have politics today, or democratic like the Democratic Party, but the whole tradition that gave rise to the United States of America, the tradition of being democratic. Third quality you'll see in fascist politics is anti-intellectualism. Now, I want to say before I jump into this that learning, education can take place outside of schools, much less outside of universities. There's lots of ways that we learn. Intelligent debate, he says, is impossible without an education, again, any kind of education, with access to different perspectives, a respect for expertise when one's own knowledge gives out, and a rich enough language to precisely describe reality. You don't have those things. You can't have intelligent debate, and we need that for a democracy. Whether or not it is a formal education, an advanced education, something that just happens in conversation with friends, it has to respect the mind. So one example is the movement in this country to, instead of teaching students to wrestle with history, with the different versions that often conflict, and to figure out how do we trust, how do we reach a decision about what we think really happened, there's a movement to replace that with the mythic past. You can see how the 10 things all intertwine and support each other. That is a form of anti-intellectualism. Don't use your mind, don't engage with history, just learn this version that we want to teach you. Number four, unreality. Stanley says, fascist politics exchanges reality for the pronouncements of a single individual or perhaps a political party. By replacing the world with a person, fascist politics makes us unable to assess arguments by a common standard. And one of the best tools for this aim is the conspiracy theory. Fascist politics thrives on them. Although they, of course, are not limited to totalitarians, fascists, communists, left, right. Fascist politicians love them. The Nazis, for example, made the great, lasting, devastating conspiracy theory called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion a foundation of their new society. They weren't the first. Decades earlier, the protocols were promulgated, literally printed by the thousands and distributed on our shores by Henry Ford. The fifth is hierarchy, not a temporary hierarchy set up to make an organization work well, such as a work environment. In the ideals of liberal democracy, those are useful, but they don't replace the fundamental equality of all people. For fascist politics, nature ordains a permanent, inescapable hierarchy into which we are all born and which it is wrong, according to them, to resist. Wrong, pointless, against nature itself. You know what some of those hierarchies are. Men are superior to women. White European people are superior to people of color from all over the world, etc. It's written in nature's laws and not to be overcome. Number six is victimhood. If the world isn't conforming to this hierarchy and you are supposed to be on the top tier, you may suffer a sense of loss and thus victimhood. The aggrieved nature of fascist politics is visible all around us and in the past when we look at fascist regimes throughout the world and history. It's not fair. We're being replaced. They're taking over. That person is dominating, or that kind of person. Stanley notes, and I agree with him, that the sense of loss may be real. A loss in status hurts, after all. But fascist politics tends that sense of grievance, encourages it, and turns its ire against the people who simply want equality. So an example from our own time, the accusation that LGBT people want special rights instead of equal rights. Number 7 is law and order. Now, while a healthy democracy is governed by laws that treat all people equally, fascist politics divides people into classes and calls one group lawful and the other one inherently lawless. Stanley gives the example of the Central Park Five, the five black teenagers in 1989 who were quickly accused when a horrific crime was committed in New York City. Their prosecution was a rallying cry for those seeking law and order, but they were actually innocent. So again, the 10 work together. This is a case of propaganda using the language we all agree on. We want justice, we want due process, to promote its opposite. The people seeking law and order were actually seeking a judicial lynching. Because the Central Park Five were members of a class defined by fascist politics as lawless. That way they could be put down in the interest of law and order. Number 8 is sexual anxiety. Part of the hierarchy and the mythic past is this powerful patriarchy that puts men in control. In particular, they have sole control over the sexual beings of women, over women's bodies, over women's sexual activity, over women's reproduction. Therefore, myths of rape fuel fascist politics. Nazi Germany had a myth of how Jews were raping Gentiles. Here in our country, the myth of the black rapist of white women has imprisoned and lynched countless thousands. In fact, our history is actually full of white men raping black women, since that was one of the prerogatives of the slaveholder or the Jim Crow white citizen, but that doesn't fit the myth. The 9th, Jason Stanley calls Sodom and Gomorrah. It can be summed up as a fear of the city. Fascist politicians try to appeal to the countryside and its supposed purity. They play the people of the country against the people of the cities. Most people in the 20s and 30s thought of Vienna as a pinnacle of Western civilization. Beautiful art and architecture, music, food, just a wonderful city. Hitler railed against it. He considered it a dragon, a dangerous place. And that playing off of the city against the countryside, each drawn mythically, is a key part of fascist politics. And finally, to use the German, as Jason Stanley does, there's Arbeit macht frei. Work will set you free. Fascist politics proclaims that whatever troubles one suffers, especially if one is claiming to be oppressed by fascist politics, the solution is one's own effort. Self-sufficiency is the god, and all counter-narratives that suggest that maybe none of us is completely self-sufficient are treated as threats and lies. This is playing out in our own time in Myanmar, where the Rohingya are made unable to work because of the laws of the government, and then they are called parasitic because they aren't self-sufficient. Of course, even the people in the Buddhist majority are not self-sufficient, but especially those who are forced into unemployment and refugee camps are not. So in the service she led last month, Reverend Kat gave us a few nuggets for resisting fascism. Don't obey in advance, but instead be an outstander. Rebel against the narrative of hopelessness. This world, which we belong to and which belongs to us, is still in formation and nothing is inevitable. I want to pick up and speak about something specific. Fascism thrives on fear. To deny it its nourishment, as the poet Jack Gilbert writes, we must risk delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight, not enjoyment. We must have the stubbornness to accept our gladness in the ruthless furnace of this world, to make injustice the only measure of our attention is to praise the devil. There's another word for what he's alluding to. I would call it joy. It's so easy when you see these signs of fascist politics around you, well, I speak for myself, to doom scroll on them, to say, you won't believe what they're doing now, to whoever's in the room, to fret and worry, and fret and worry are natural responses. I'm not saying to just cover it all up and pretend everything is fine. But I think what Gilbert is urging us to do, and what works against fascist politics, is to tap into the sources of our joy and hope and faith and love, which are part of what make it possible. Joy does at least two really important things when fascism threatens. The first is that when we get tired and discouraged, as is bound to happen, it buoys us. We have work to do to protect our political system, to fight back against the untruths, the mythic past, and the propaganda that we're hearing, the unreality that people may try to make dominant. That all takes work, and we get tired. And it's really important, as well as fun, to tap into our joy. And there's so many ways that people are doing this. Look up joy as resistance, and you'll see lots of examples. The people who founded the Rikers Island Community Garden were thinking about it. Rikers Island, if you don't know, is the prison for the city of New York. And there is a garden there for prisoners to work while they are imprisoned by the city of New York. They can make things grow, and they can encounter this deep meaning, hope, and joy of seeing things come out of the earth, even eating the things that grow right there on Rikers Island. They're going to close the prison, and I really hope that whatever places they set up in the future, they put a garden there as well. There are countless examples of movements like the climate change movement realizing people are tired and discouraged and they don't know whether what they're doing is going to work. So we discovered we need to dance at our protests. We need to sing. People are discovering right now, as terrifying racist mobs take to the streets in the UK, for example, that if they just flood the streets, not just with protests and signs and stop this and don't do that, but with singing and celebration, a great big block party, the racists stay home. It's not what they're looking for. They want to get people afraid, and they want to get them angry. And we will be afraid and angry, absolutely. I'm sure the people who went out into the streets in the UK were. But they led with their joy, and they tapped into their joy, because it's really hard to be lost in your fear and depression and anger when you're singing with all hundreds of people. The other thing that joy does, besides buoy us up and keep us strong for the struggle, is it reminds us of our own positive vision of the world we want. It is so exhausting to just be against something, and that too is what can happen. The louder and louder oppressive voices get, like fascist politicians, the more we think, I don't want that, I don't want that, I have to say what I'm against. It's all true, but it's a constant rearguard effort. And after a while, it feels like the only reward we can imagine is at least the worst won't happen. When we remember not only what we are struggling against, but what we're for, that's tapping into our joy, and that gives us tremendous energy, as well as something that other people might actually want to follow. You know, the gardener does not just pull weeds in order to have a plot without weeds. She has a vision she's working towards of abundant flowers, of tomato plants heavy with fruit. That possible future is what makes the digging and bending in the hot sun not drudgery, but a channel for joy. It's not just labor against the constant influx of agents of chaos, in this case known as weeds. It's work to bring forth something beautiful and greatly desired. So several years ago, it was before COVID, a couple years, so we made this, people made squares of this quilt. I know I already have this mic, I'm just paranoid. During a service, Kathy Swartz made it into a gorgeous quilt, I think with her son Tyler's help. And I asked people in the service, what's a dream you have for 5 years from now? Thinking particularly about the community, but many of them were very personal. A green card so I can stay here, for example, with a smiley face. And they have intentions in them, this positive world that we want to see. May the golden rule reign. Health for all. My dream is to have a puppy. I hope Sophia got a puppy. Family harmony, that's something that you can work towards if you have that vision in your mind. A fearless heart. Truly sustainable living. A world where our children know how to be the change because we modeled it. You can come see lots more up here after the service. So here in the political realm, you know, when we hear what fascist politics is trying to stir up, you know, if immigration to us is not a nightmare scenario of, you know, rapists and so on coming into the country, but it's actually one of the things that makes our communities strong and beautiful and interesting, then we can claim that out loud. That's our positive vision. Go to the festivals of the Peruvian or Greek or Irish or Tongan communities. Build friendships with people of all ethnicities. Tell the stories of our immigrant family members. Heck, try cooking a new dish that we learned about from an immigrant-run restaurant. This is how we say, I love a country full of migrants. Yeah, you know, maybe I have policy questions to talk about, but I'm not going to buy into the scapegoating, which is part of that law and order thing that fascist politics like to do. Oh, those people are inherently lawless, and we have to stand for law, which means to oppress them. Or if equality of all people to us is not a dangerous concept, but one we embrace, then we can practice it. One of the dangers of fascist politics, in Stanley's words, is the particular way in which it dehumanizes segments of the population. If, in contrast, equality and empathy are among our chief values, we can nurture the connection, the opportunities for connection to all of humanity, the opportunities for feeling that empathy and recognizing that we are one, such as we will celebrate next week in our water communion. So be there. So I wanted to give you one more tool to counter any fascist politics that may be roiling in your life. That's where the sticker comes in. We can begin today by sharing our anchors of joy and hope and love and faith with one another. At coffee hour, or if you're able to stay, and I hope you are, over lunch. If I may cite Matt Rosin without embarrassing him. Matt, in Matt's blog, he suggested his favorite question for those moments when small talk runs out. Can I get an amen from the introverts in the crowd? Woo! Yeah, they're not afraid to shout out loud. We'll do that when there's a crowd. Matt said his favorite question is, what's been bringing you joy lately? So not just today, after the service, but whenever we meet, we might ask each other, what's been bringing you joy lately? And that can help us be buoyed, remember our positive vision, and make the world we dream about. May it be so.